Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
New U.S. sanctions on Iran took effect today, 6 months after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the international nuclear deal.
The sanctions target Iran's shipping, financial, and energy sectors, all key to the country's already struggling economy.
The bombs, which the FBI referred to as improvised explosive devices, were sent to the FBI's bomb laboratory in Quantico, Virginia.
We're in Mexico again tonight as thousands of migrants try to find a faster way to the U.S. border. The White House says it's now getting help from the Mexican.
Breaking news out of Pittsburgh. A man accused in the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh is pleading not guilty, and he also wants a jury trial. He's facing a 44 counts up.
In the final seconds before the Boeing 737 MAX crashed into the water, it was traveling at more than 500 kilometers an hour. All 189 people on board were killed.
You've now entered the House of Mystery.
Crime, conspiracy, history, and science.
With your hosts, Al Warren, Mike Brown,
Julie Sav, Michael Butterfield,
Dr. Joseph Usinski, and Michael Hawley.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Lucy, I'm home.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren, of course, sitting at the controls. And co-hosting today is David North Martino.
I am here.
Yeah, you are. I was on TV last night. How was that?
That was awesome. It was good.
Yeah. I guess it turned out okay.
Yeah.
But I'm better than Donnie Wahlberg. Come on.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah. We should have mentioned Very Scary People.
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, go watch that episode.
It was funny because I was getting emails saying that you didn't look that scary. It's like, how rude.
Yeah, I know.
Well, so now we have a returning guest, and we're going to be talking about a crime that happens out in your neck of the woods. And I would be surprised if you weren't involved.
I was. Don't tell anybody, though. No. It's just between you and me.
Yeah, don't let anybody know. We won't let them. We won't. You just keep it closed. So now, returning to the show, we have Maureen Boyle. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. I always love being on your show.
Well, you're the only one. No. Well, I appreciate having you on, and you do good work. And this is your latest book. Now, it's coming out June 1st, so that will be tomorrow for the listeners in L.A. Now, the book is called The Ghost.
Yes, The Ghost, the murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and the hunt for his killer.
How did you come across this case?
Well, the killer in this case was originally from this area. And after my first book, Shallow Graves, came out, I was looking for the subject of another, for a second book. And this on this case, which was an interesting cold case, it was a solved but unsolved cold case. By that I mean Greg Adams was a police chief in the small community of Saxonburg, Pennsylvania. He was 31 years old when he made a traffic stop, and he was killed. He was about a block and a half away from the police station, about 2 or 3 weeks before Christmas, and the killer took off. Very quickly, the police were able to identify the likely killer, and it took a few days to do that because the killer dropped his driver's license, but the driver's license wasn't under his own name, and this is 1980, and in that pre-computer era, everything had to be done by hand or by footwork, and state police investigators fanned throughout the region and throughout the states to track down who the person was, the name that was on that driver's license. And once they identified the person, then it was a matter of trying to find him. And it took quite a while to be able to trace where he had been, where he had gone. He was the, in his time, think of Whitey Bulger. Right. Whitey Bulger was a mobster out of Boston who took off, and he was on the top 10, FBI's top 10 most wanted list. Well, this individual, Donald Webb, who is the killer, was in some ways the Whitey Bulger of his time. Police throughout the region were looking for him. The FBI had him in their sights, trying to identify where he was. And a lot of work went into it, but it took quite a long time to come to what I call a very startling conclusion.
Yeah, it's quite the case. How do you choose a case like this? Like when, because this is not the only murder that's around that area. So, what is it about this case that drew you in?
Secrets. I find secrets really intriguing. In my first book, Shallow Graves: A Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer, which detailed the killings, the disappearance of 11 women in 1988, out of the community of New Bedford, which is a fishing port. And New Bedford's a very small community, very tight-knit community, and I've always felt that the killer is from that area, and someone in the community knows who the killer is, and they're holding on to the secret. And when this story came up, I was drawn to it because of the secret. How could a Donald Webb elude authorities for so long? Who held his secret? Because he couldn't do it alone. And I found it really fascinating trying to just pull apart who he was and the effect that the murder had on the community of Saxonburg, and most importantly, the effect that it had on the police chief's family, because at the time he had two small children.
Yeah, and that was a small town, or still, you know, there was only like, what, 1,200, 1,300 people there?
Yes, and it's a lovely, lovely community. If anyone is in that part of Pennsylvania, I really urge you to swing by Saxonburg. It is like Mayberry, USA. It is just a lovely, lovely, very homey, warm community.
So that must have really shocked them, right? Because this is a small place, like you said, Mayberry, so everyone knows everyone, and not a whole lot goes on, you know.
No, not
stuff
much.
Like this, right?
Yeah, not much at all. I mean, when we went to Saxonburg, we went to Saxonburg twice for roughly a week at a time to do research. And I was really struck by the number of people who remembered the chief and how the community really rallied to keep his memory alive. He was never forgotten. And the fact that the killer had not been caught never left them. And that is something very, very special that not a lot of communities have.
How is that? But when you go, I understand because I've been out and investigated crimes in person. So how is it for you when you go out and you go to a town like that and you start digging up such a bad thing that happened? Were people pretty supportive and very open?
Yes, they were very, very supportive. I had spoken to many of the people in the community prior to this and let them know that I would be going down there. So I didn't just show up one day in Saxonburg and say, hey, here I am. I'm here to talk to everyone about this case. I first went down there for a dedication, a street dedication in honor of the chief. And, prior to that, I had interviewed most of the people, or a good number of the people for the book, and then went down there both for the dedication to meet people in person and to talk to them more in depth. And to meet other people and to actually see the areas where this crime took place, to see where the chief once lived, to see where the police department is, to see where the crime happened. It was really important, as people say, to show up. And because I had been a newspaper reporter for so long, I'm used to doing those cold calls and just talking to people out of the blue. I was not intimidated by that at all.
We always hear about the killer. Did you find out what the chief was like?
The chief was the complete opposite of the killer. The chief was good. He was the light to the killer's darkness, if you will. He was worked hard, was a family man, really dedicated to his family and his extended family. He taught at the police academy. He was a small town boy. He had moved to Washington at one point, but just really was drawn back home. He did everything right, and that's the horror, I think, of it all. That here is someone who did everything right, and this is what happened to him, and he did not get the justice initially that he well deserved.
So when we talk about the murder itself,
yes.
I find it quite striking because. The way I understand it is the chief had stopped the killer, but we didn't know he was the killer at the time, but he had stopped him in a parking lot of, I believe, a feed store or something.
Yep.
And so anyway, I was going to say, but, a scuffle happened, and then the actual culprit or bad guy actually got out of the car and beat him as well, the cop, after shooting him. Now, do we know why it got so heated?
At the time, Donald Webb was wanted in New York. He had skipped out on bail up in New York, and the theory is that possibly he thought that he didn't want to go back to jail, and he thought that the chief would run, check on him, and he'd be caught. However, this was 1980, and the technology that police officers have today is not the technology that they had back then in terms of checking licenses. And the license that Donald Webb was using was a phony. So even if, this is what I find the heartbreaking part of all of this, even if the chief had checked the license, called in, it wouldn't have come back to a Donald Webb who was wanted. And like a full check probably would have taken so much longer, Webb would have been gone. So that's what makes the killing so senseless. All killings are senseless, but how this all broke down is just appalling. And it's heartbreaking.
So exactly, maybe you can explain the actual killing part, because I didn't do it very well. But so what actually happened that night?
What is believed to have happened, because no one knows exactly what happened then, but it's believed that for whatever reason, the chief pulled Donald Webb over, and they pulled into the parking lot of an Agway. Which is off of one of the main streets. It was a side street off of the main street of town, about a block and a half away from the police station. And, you know, he may have run a stop sign. He may have been speeding. That's kind of unclear. And when he pulled him over, the way the cars were believed to have been stopped, it wasn't quite the way law enforcement generally are trained to stop them. But the two of them are in the vehicle. The chief gets out of the car, goes up to the vehicle. Obviously, he has the license, which is under the name of Stanley Portis. And he is believed to have possibly gone back, or was going towards the back to his vehicle. And something happened. There was a scuffle. It's not known if Webb came out and attacked the chief, or the chief tried to take him into custody. It's just not clear exactly what happened in that initial moment. What is known is that there was a vicious, vicious struggle that went from the parking lot to some homes that were right next to the parking lot, the backyards of the homes, a vicious struggle. Shots were fired, and a young boy who was home from school heard what sounded like someone hitting a tree, like a bang, bang, bang. And then he heard someone yelling, "Help me, help me." The boy was home from school because he was ill, and he called down to his mother. His mother was like, "Oh, come on, what's going on here?" And they look out the window. They don't see anything initially. They look out another window, and they see a figure outside. They go outside. The mom tells her son to go dial 911, and she recognizes the person in the backyard as the police chief, and he's telling her, "Help me, help me." And what they didn't realize, he was dying at that moment. He had been shot and fatally wounded.
Wow.
There was blood found both of the chief and the suspect at the scene. And based on that, law enforcement had believed that perhaps the chief had also shot the suspect. And right after that, everything was shut down around town. State police were called out. Local police, now this was a very small department, so state police were there immediately because the barracks was in the town next door. They've got helicopters in the air, troopers in the area. They're blocking off all the roads. And the killer just seemed to have vanished. They had a description of the vehicle. No one saw the vehicle after it left the scene. And it took a couple of days before they were able to identify the killer as Donald Webb, who was from was living in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
Do we know what he was doing in that area? Like why he came through Saxonburg?
He, Yeah, he was a low-level mobster. He had a crew out of Fall River, Massachusetts, which was a city near New Bedford. And they would go from community to community, not in their home state. They would go outside, states away, where no one knew them. And they would burglarize jewelry stores, houses that had a lot of fine goods. They did a lot of scams. So they would do that and break into houses in New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, New York, and other communities south. They would go all over doing this, and then come back and fence the goods.
Oh, so how did they actually tie it to Donald Webb? Like, what was it that what was the clue that they got?
It was the driver's license, but it wasn't that easy. They had to peel back multiple layers to get to his identification, because it all had to be by hand. It was all, talking to people, because things were not computerized.
Yeah.
And they discovered, through a series of events, which I document in the book, that his real name was not Stanley Portis, but Donald Webb. It had to do with a number of the vehicle that he was renting. So they were able to peel back these layers and finally peel back deep enough and discover that Stanley Portis was really Donald Webb. And that took a couple of days, actually more than a week, before they really narrowed down who he was.
Yeah, it was the dark
ages. And during that period of time, he was able to really scoot out of the area. It's believed that he, right after the killing, he left Pennsylvania and went right to Massachusetts. And then he just disappeared.
Was he known as a killer? Like, had he killed before?
No, he was not considered a violent offender, per se. He was a type of person who was rob things, not at gunpoint, except for a bank robbery. But generally, they would break into stores, jewelry stores, homes, things like that, looking for items that they could turn over very, very quickly. It wasn't he wasn't a confrontational robber. So he was not known as a killer.
Hmm.
He did have some ties to the Rhode Island mob, but just very loose ties, because he was selling a lot of his goods there.
It seems like it's quite a violent murder as well. For someone that hadn't done any killing before. I wonder if, was he like a drug addict, or do we know?
No, he wasn't a drug addict. And that's what's interesting, that he was not known at least as a killer, was not known as being violent until that moment. So we're not sure what the twist was in there, and most likely it was that he did not want to return to prison, and that was the impetus to this. The police chief, while he was a very slight man, he was known as a fighter. He was not going to go down, and he was not someone who would be intimidated. So the confrontation between the two should not have been deadly, but it did turn out to be that way, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And it was what I find fascinating with this case is how the process of the law enforcement and how they were able to step by meticulous step first identify Donald Webb in a time when there weren't surveillance cameras all over the place. You know, when there wasn't searches were not done by computer. You didn't find names with a click of a button. You had to go knocking on doors, and they went knocking on doors. The state police fanned out to two, then later four states initially. Number one, to identify the killer, get his real name. And then once they had an idea of earlier on, an idea that there may be a link to Massachusetts, that was when the FBI stepped in New Bedford, because they had a New Bedford office. And then things seemed to both come together and fall apart.
He had to also hide out from the mob itself, the Patriarcha family, or was he not connected enough, like when he disappeared?
Well, that was what was up in the air. I honestly don't think he was connected enough for it to matter. And I don't think that he was running from them. I think he was afraid of going to prison for the rest of his life. Would the Patriarcha family have killed him? I don't know. It depends on if he did some other things that warranted him not remaining with the living. But he wasn't. I don't think he was connected enough for it to matter. They had other people out there to deal with.
So was Donald Webb married or had kids or anything at the time that he killed the police chief?
Yep, he was originally from the Oklahoma area and had lived in the western part of the state. But when he joined the service, he came to Massachusetts, where he eventually stayed and, of course, did time. And he eventually married a young widow who had a small child, and that's who he was married to at the time of the killing. And they did go knocking on her door, trying to, find him at her house, and she insisted that he wasn't there. And it turns out he actually was not at her house when they came knocking on the door in the initial part of the investigation. But they kept his wife under fairly close watch in those early days and weeks and months. But they were not able to locate him, and he did not appear to have gone to her house in the initial phase of the investigation. Even when once Pennsylvania State Police came up to Massachusetts to go tracking where Donald Webb might be. His stepson was, it turns out the alias that Donald Webb was using was his wife's first husband's name, Stanley Portis.
Wow. So
yeah, so he's using his wife's dead husband's name as one of his many aliases, and he had a license. And that license that was found at the crime scene. So initially they were looking for Stanley Portis, who, not knowing that Stanley Portis had been long dead.
Well, so the way he got away with this, in the fact that he changed his name and he had quite a few aliases and did all these low-level crimes, does that indicate that there's probably a lot of other people out there like him doing the same thing back then?
Yes. Yes. Back then, there was not, and it was really well documented in the 1980s. This was a major problem. Back then, criminals, really violent criminals who were wanted were often, or occasionally, and sometimes often, stopped by police. But because there wasn't a central database for those that were wanted. They would get a ticket and then go off. So, and in some cases, they would be using their own name. So there was, this happened quite often. There was a number of cases in California. There's been cases documented in the 1980s throughout the country where people who were wanted were stopped by police, but the officers were unaware that the individual was wanted because there was no way to find out that they were wanted because there wasn't a central database at that time. It was very, very spotty.
All right, so now you mentioned the FBI, so they got involved in this. What brought them into the case, and what did they do?
The FBI had always been involved in it, but, you know, as the decades passed, and this was decades, there was a couple of...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
FBI agents were very, very active. They were also active in the Whitey Bulger case. And this case, they had heard about it, and it really bothered them that Donald Webb had not been found, had not been located, had not been brought to justice. Here is someone that was on the top 10 most wanted, and somehow he just eluded authorities. He killed a police chief, and he's still out there. So they made it their mission to find him. And the path that they took wound up involving, in some interesting ways, the Pennsylvania State Police, prosecutors in Pennsylvania, prosecutors in Bristol County here in Massachusetts, the Attorney General's office here, and of course the FBI. There was teams from the State Police in Massachusetts, State Police in Pennsylvania, and the FBI all working together, and working together really well without any ego. In this shared mission to identify where Donald Webb was and to finally put the case to a close. And that's why they were able to do it. And they all worked together so very, very well. There wasn't any egos. They were all giving each other credit, and particularly with the FBI. One of the main FBI agents, because if I say the FBI agent, he would get very upset because he always says there's so many people that were involved. Tommy McDonald, everyone says he was one of the driving forces of the case. He would say, oh no, so-and-so helped me and so-and-so helped me, and there's this person and there's that person. Because that's the type of person, individual and investigator he is, always sharing the credit, knowing that with a case this large, it's a team that will help solve it. And that is what happened. It was everyone working together. And it was just so impressive. I know that there had been a number of conspiracy theories, as there always is in any case involving the disappearance of Donald Webb. You know, was he in protective custody? Was he like Whitey Bulger, you know, telling on the mob? And that is, as in all conspiracy theories, very often they aren't true. And in this case, from all the research that I did, I could honestly say there was no, you know, conspiracy to keep Donald Webb hidden from justice. But the ending of it and the conclusion of the case really highlights that. I mean, I really cannot say enough about the work that Tommy McDonald, Phil Torsney, and a host of other FBI agents, past and present, put into this case. I mean, we're going back to, you know, the 1980s and the investigators there, how they worked together, the FBI investigators and the state police, how well they worked together was really amazing. It really goes against the talk today that, you know, the FBI doesn't cooperate. And in this case, they did.
Mm. Yeah, it's there's been a lot of negative press, you know, about all that policing and stuff like that. It's hard right now. And even journalism. So it's a tough time for a lot of people. It's interesting, though. I mean, I believe it was aliens. Aliens came down. And
well, you know what? That would have been, if it happened today, that would have been one of the theories. And you know what? There may be some people out there who would say that was it. You know, and there were weird theories at that point that, you know, Donald Webb was in protective custody, that he was on an island someplace, you know, sipping a drink. He was, you know, in a foreign country, that he had another family, that he was dead. And there was just so many theories out there of what happened to him, because it was just so odd that he could just vanish. And that's what it appeared. That he just vanished.
He was hanging on an island with Elvis.
Yes, exactly.
It wasn't too long after that. Elvis wasn't that 77 or something that he died? So he didn't really die. He's hanging on an island with him. Come on.
I mean, there was even one theory that because the chief had worked in D.C. and he had done some undercover work, that somehow some of his arrests down there, the drug dealers hunted him down years later in Saxonburg and killed him. That was another theory that was thrown out there.
Did Hillary Clinton do it?
If it happened today, it would be said that somehow she would have been involved. She's blamed for everything.
Yeah, she did it. She made a phone call and it was done.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I know. It's hard to deal with that sort of stuff. So what is it? Did you know, doing this whole case and getting the book written, was there anything that you took away that you sort of learned about law enforcement and these kinds of crimes that you didn't really know before?
Well, this was the first time that I did FOIA requests for FBI files. And what I did learn is that it takes a real long time to get FOIA requests answered. Because it has to go through the whole process, and that you really have to be very specific in what areas you're looking for in a case, because it can get overly, very, very expensive, you may not get the right information. So you kind of have to know the information that you're looking for before you ask for it. Sort of like lawyers when they're quizzing witnesses on the stand. Yeah, they know what the answer is going to be, but they need to have it on the record. That was one thing that I learned from all of this. The other thing about law enforcement, I had a good idea from covering police and covering the courts as a daily journalist for so many years. But what I did learn from all of this is, and this was a good thing, how interagencies do cooperate because of the that feeling. And I had always been told by different cops that, you know, the feds won't tell you if your pants are on fire, that, you know, that type of thing, that they won't give you any information. And in this case, that wasn't what happened. From the point of the killing in Pennsylvania, what I discovered is how close members of law enforcement from different agencies really are. For example, the FBI resident agent office in Pennsylvania, one of the agents there was good friends with a state trooper who was also investigating the case. He was also friends with the agent who was in New Bedford at the time. And that agent was close friends with a couple of people in the state police who were also involved in the investigation. So it really is more of a close circle than walled off fortresses. At least in this case, that may be different in some other cases, but
yeah,
not here. And I was very pleased to see and hear about that level of cooperation, and there was no bad-mouthing of each agency for the most part.
Well, that's because that group over there where you are, it's they're all body snatched, right? They're aliens. And they all know each other from another planet, so it's, you know, there is no separation there. They know what's going on. They don't even have to talk.
But you know, it did give me an insight, even more of an insight, to some of the barriers that law enforcement face in being able to get information and to get suspects. Because when you, under the law, there's a lot of things police and other members of law enforcement cannot do. And that can be a barrier to finding a suspect, because legally there's certain things they cannot do. They can't go barging into a house without a warrant. You can't get a warrant without a judge signing off, and you can't get a judge to sign off on it unless you have probable cause, and the probable cause has to be really detailed. So you can't just say, I want to do something. You have to show why, and that there's a reason for it, and whatever you're looking for would be there. I think people will come away after reading the book a better understanding of how things work in real life as opposed to how we want things to work, especially when it comes to policing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I was just going to ask that, what you wanted or expected or hoped that people would get after reading the book. So that's kind of the main point there.
Yes. And I think they will come away with a much better understanding of law enforcement. But they'll also come away with a sense of hope, I hope. A hope that, you know, things do work out sort of at the end, that communities do work together, that people care. And that was just so clear when I first stepped into the town of Saxonburg, that people in the community still remembered the chief. You know, decades later, they still were looking for answers. They still honored him every year. They did not forget, and they really kept his memory alive. And that was tragically refreshing. And I say tragically because you know, we are talking about the death of a young police chief and a young father. And it was refreshing that to know that people don't forget. They don't forget that they're dead. They don't forget that a killer is out there. And they don't give up hope that things will work out. And, you know, sometimes things don't work out the way you hope they would, but they do work out the way they have to. And that that was something that I learned from all of this.
Yeah.
And the togetherness of the community is just so, it really makes you feel good about your fellow man. Now, this was all prior to the pandemic, and I'm glad I was there before the world turned upside down, because I was really able to see what a wonderful community the chief had served.
Mm. Yeah, and it's important right now. Because people get lost in this sea of hate, you know, all this stuff about, you know, cops and all this, you know, people are calling each other names all the time. And I think the bottom line is that it's about people, and there are good people and bad people, and that's in every business, whether they're police, radio guys, whether they're writers. You're going to come across people that care and then people that don't. So, you know, rather than to just put them all in one spot. To realize that it's the type of person that you're dealing with, you know. And COVID, that didn't happen. That's not real, is it?
Well, you tell that to the people who died, you know, their families.
Yeah, I know. But that's a perfect example, you know. It's just people get lost in this, you know, hollow cause of something. And yeah. It's about feelings. So it's good to have a story like this that kind of highlights that there are good people in policing and in the world trying to do the right thing. So that's important.
And you know, and we have to remember that life is all about the middle, and what I call the gray area. Often when things happen, there's reasons why they happen, and you have to look at the root causes. And that's what I was looking at when I examined Donald Webb's life, to see how he got to this point, to the day of the killing, you know, his background, to understand him, and to understand the chief, to understand the community, and to understand how things could crash together. So tragically, because, you know, we're always looking for that quick, simple answer. And what you discover, and what I discovered through this book and also with Shallow Graves, is sometimes answers are not easily gotten, and they are not simple. They never are. As much as we would like to in this era of instant gratification, instant answers, where you know something with a few, you know, a clicks on the keyboard. In life, it's often not that way. And that's what I discovered with my research and talking to people with this book, The Ghost, is that life is on the edges. Life is in the middle. It's not cut and dry. It's never simple. And that's what I really hope to bring out in the book. How Donald Webb got to where he was, how the chief came to cross paths with him, and the consequences for the community, the consequences for his family, consequences for law enforcement and everyone who was touched by this case. And there were just so many people that were touched by this case. Even more than I spoke with.
What do you think the biggest surprise was for you in doing this?
The probably, other than how the case ends it, but we won't get into that. there'll be no spoilers here. The biggest surprise probably was that the secret was kept for so long. And for that, I was very, very disappointed with all the people who may have kept Webb's secret. There's one or two people that you could say, okay, we understand that, but I suspect there is many more who knew and didn't come forward. And in a community like the greater New Bedford community, that was, I think, really disappointing. Because it left this family, the chief's family, hanging for so long. That was my big takeaway and, you know, my biggest disappointment when I got some of those answers.
Wow. So now, do you have a website and a place that people can come find you?
Yes, it would be MaureenBoyleWriter.com.
Okay. And we'll have that up on our website for people.
Yeah, and they can also follow me on, I have an author's Facebook page, Maureen Boyle Writer. And also there's a Facebook page for the book, which is The Ghost, The Murder of Police Chief Greg Adams and The Hunt for His Killer.
Yeah, and that'll be on our page too. People can do one click and pick it up if they're listening online. Hey, so when you write something like this too, I don't know about you, but I know I feel a tremendous amount of responsibility when you're writing a true case with people that are still around, still alive, that were involved or part of it. That must be the hardest part of writing this book for you, or is it something else?
No, that is to do both the those that are living and those that are dead justice, and getting to the heart of the story. But yeah, writing about people who are still living, I did go back to many of the investigators multiple times for fact checking and to make sure that I got some of the nuances correct, making sure that I had everything, particularly in Pennsylvania, correct in terms of townships and that sort of thing. And that was one element of it. But going back to your question about talking to and doing justice to the people who are living, I mean, this case was a huge part of their lives. And they want the world to know what they did. This is their legacy and it is very, very important legacy. It's an important story. They made a difference. And they're all very proud of what they did. A little bit sad that it was a case involving someone who has been killed, a police chief who has been killed, but they are still proud that they were able to bring it to a conclusion.
So what's up next for you?
I'm working on researching now. I think I'm crazy. At least I think my family thinks I'm crazy. I'm doing research on two other books, one set in Pennsylvania, and one that's set up here in Massachusetts.
That's a pretty wicked state there, Massachusetts. Eh? A lot of bad stuff going on there.
Oh, mm-hmm. You know, you're going to find it anywhere. You find it in the small towns. And you know, I was on interviewed on a documentary recently about the Fall River cult murders. And I mean, that's a whole other weird case. That came up here even before I arrived into Massachusetts. But, you know, you go into any community and there is always something weird under the surface. Whether it's recent or decades later, there's always something there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a good thing. And so you've got, you avoided the COVID. Has the COVID sort of affected you in your writing of the new books now or what you're doing now?
I was very lucky with the ghost. I had all of my research done. I was just going back. It was one of those things where I should go back to the library and double check this or look at this, or maybe I can look at this other thing. But it sort of forced me to sit and finish it. With the other two books, during the shutdown, I was able to do a lot of phone interviews and Zoom interviews with people, and that passed the day both for them and for me. So I was able to get some research done on both of those.
Yeah. But just the whole, I was thinking too, like with the world the way it is, like just with all the turmoil going on, you know, all the stuff happening the last couple of years, does that seep into your writing, do you think? Do you sort of get kind of down on the way you write?
Because my recent books were set in the past, I'm going back in time. So in some ways it's a little bit easier. Although during the whole shutdown, it can be a bit depressing because you're not seeing people and you're just surrounded by death, if you will. So as a result, to clear my head, I watch very bad TV. You know, I watch old sitcoms. I watch Dragnet in the morning, I encourage people to watch Dragnet because the show was really ahead of its time. If you really watch and analyze it, they covered every conceivable topic that's pertinent to today back then.
Ah, so there you go. Well, yeah,
people laugh about it, but you laugh at the show, because it's kind of campy, but they did tackle some really serious subjects.
That's all I watch is old shows. So me TV all day long. Well, it's been a great conversation. We've learned a lot, and certainly it's been a pleasure having you on. And God, I didn't realize Hillary Clinton was involved way back then. But we appreciate finding out. So now the book. The Ghost, and it's
the Ghost.
The murder of Police Chief Greg Adams.
And the hunt for his killer.
You got it. And our guest today was Maureen Boyle, who's the researcher and author. Thank you for being on the show.
Okay, and thank you. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you for having me on, as always.
Thanks, Maureen.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.